This is The Takeaway for Thursday, February 2nd, Groundhog Day 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. In our attempts each day to understand some of the expectations and feelings of the Americans who voted in the 2016 election and are eager for President Donald Trump to now make good on some of his even more controversial campaign pledges, we spoke with Norm Crider on the program yesterday. I don't know if you heard it. He's a Marine Corps veteran and supporter of this week's Trump immigration order. He, along with 49% of Americans polled by Reuters this week, on some level support that Trump order, while a still sizable 41% of Americans oppose it to varying degrees. I asked Norm Crider if he felt safer with this order in place and if it was worth it to disadvantage people coming to America from Muslim-majority countries to make the country safe. This was his response.
I question why people from a culture that's very different than the normal culture of America want to come halfway around the world when they could maybe seek asylum in a country more close to their home, more culturally in tune with who they are. I question why they come here. I think we need to question why America? Why do they want to come here?
You use the word normal culture of America. What do you mean by that?
Well, the normal cultures of America, Muslims do not make up a very large percentage of this country. It's a very, very small minority of people who believe in Islam.
Fastest growing religion in the U.S.
It is. And a lot of that is because we've opened the door and we're allowing thousands and thousands of people to come here that believe this religion.
Now, Norm Crider was speaking from Joplin, Missouri. Many of you were upset by his comments about what constitutes a normal America. And on our website, Wed Listener wrote that she was appalled by Mr. Crider's regurgitation of misinformation about Muslims. Many people said that it was wrong of us to even have allowed him to speak those values about Muslims. Hussein Rashid is professor of religion at Barnard and a Truman National Security Fellow. He's joined by Jerusha Lamptey, a professor of Islam at Union Theological Seminary here in New York and author of the book Never Holy Other. Jerusha and Hussein, welcome.
Thanks for having us on.
Your impressions of what Norm Crider said. Again, he's a military veteran and speaks from his perspective from a very high moral ground.
You know, first I want to start by thanking Marine Crider for his service. And I firmly believe that one of our values is freedom of speech. He has every right to believe what he does and say it. And I think it highlights a lot of the issues we have about educating about American values, even within some branches of the military or some, for some service members in the military, as well as about Islam more broadly. When we think about why people want to come to America, it is about those values. Nobody asked, why did the pilgrims come here when the native culture was so different? And I think that it also, when we say we swear an oath of allegiance to the Constitution in whatever public service role we choose to take on, that we hold those values as a symbol and as an emblem to the rest of the world. We want to be that shining beacon on the hill. We want to accept other people. And I find it fascinating that we're worried about Muslims coming over today as though we cared about when we brought over so many slaves who were Muslim. There was no religious litmus test at that point. And I think we have to understand the ways in which America has formed and worked historically.
Jerusha.
I would agree with Hussein that it's very important to respect and acknowledge freedom of speech. It's one of the values that people who do come here come seeking, and that people who live here, I think, generally uphold and value. That being said, I also think it's important for people to hear this kind of sentiment because it is pervasive. I encounter it all the time in classrooms, in public settings. What I would
outside
say
outside of Joplin, Missouri, it's not a,
outside
it's not
of right, it. Yeah. And why I think it's important to encounter is because we can only begin to untangle it and to provide more education about the diversity of Islam and about the fact that, yes, cultures look different, but that's nothing new in this country. That's actually what's made this country beautiful. Different people coming from different backgrounds. And on top of that, I would echo the sentiment that it also betrays a lack of knowledge about the fact that there are so many Muslims here. And so this portrayal of people coming from over there or not the normal thing is a stereotype that needs to be undone.
Outraged? Did it hit you in the gut yesterday when you heard that?
You know, when I listened to the segment, I don't feel outraged. I think I want to echo Jerusha that as an educator, this is something that comes across my radar quite a bit. It's a lot of what is in the air. People think there's only one way to be American. I'm a born and bred New Yorker. The first thing you learn growing up in this city is that there's a way to be American for every person who lives here. And I think that sometimes we forget that. And one of the most important things I teach my students is that the hardest part of human existence is learning how to deal with difference. And if we've never dealt with difference before, it becomes a frightening thing. And I remember FDR's, you know, famous statement, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
The man who put Japanese people in concentration camps.
The man who put Japanese people in internment camps, right, exactly. And so that we can have this soaring rhetoric and we can have these horrible realities. But I think part of my obligation as an American citizen is to fight for the values and ideals that we believe in. It's that Langston Hughes moment, let America be America again, that we should be able to criticize this country as part of our patriotic duty to say that we haven't lived up to our ideals, but that our ideals are worth fighting for and trying to live up to. But part of that means acknowledging where we've made mistakes rather than making those mistakes worse.
For me, I don't think it hits me as something harsh for the same reason I encounter it frequently. The wearing of a piece of fabric on my head is an immediate indicator to people that I'm somehow foreign. So I will frequently walk down the street and have people say to me, how did you learn to speak English so well? Well, I don't know. It might have been the 400 years of my family being here speaking English. So there's this immediate signification that if you are Muslim, you're somehow not like us or not from here. What I would say is it doesn't hurt me as much as disappoint me, because I think that we are better than this as people, but also in this country. We have done this, demonize and dehumanize groups of people collectively. Historically, as you point out, with Japanese internment, but obviously that's not the only case. It was with the Irish, with my family who came as Irish people here. We need to learn not to do that.
All right, so here's the challenge for I think all three of us. We're speaking on a public radio station. Public, the idea of public is very important, I think, in this particular conversation. How do we respond to Norm Crider's sentiments, his feelings that he wants America to be safe more than anything else, maybe even more than some of these values that you espouse? How do we respond to him without demonizing him, without suggesting that he's not welcome in this tent of public radio discussion, that he's wrong?
I personally think the way to do that is to go for the underlying values. He spoke about safety. I don't know anyone who does not want to be safe. I walk with my child down the street, and I want her to be safe. I don't want anyone to harm her. That is a shared value that I don't know anyone who wouldn't assent to that. When we think our safety only comes at making other people victims, that, I think, is where we need to have a conversation. And so, for me, one of the concrete things that we can do to have a more productive conversation is to start to understand these anti-Muslim sentiments or this collective responsibility, it is somewhat of a form of bias. It's stereotyping a whole entire group of people. And we can identify shared values that could be more forceful than that desire.
And we should note, and we did yesterday, that the seven countries in the ban do not have any record of sending people here who caused any violence against any Americans.
Yeah. There's no national security professional who says that this Muslim ban does anything productive at all. In fact, it is counterproductive. It's not even a neutral act. But I think more importantly that we keep talking about it in a national security lens, but fundamentally what's at stake is our character as Americans. Are we going to allow pictures of three-year-old children washing up on beaches become our new normal and perfectly acceptable? Are we going to say it is okay for people to suffer and die when we have the ability to stop it and give succor and help?
Bring help to refugees.
To refugees.
All right, then if Norm Crider was here in this studio and we were talking to him, do you have confidence that you could leave this studio as friends after a conversation about these differing beliefs and views?
You know, Maureen Crider has served this country, and so I believe that we have an intimate and innate connection to wanting to defend this country against enemies foreign and domestic, to uphold and defend the Constitution. And I think that alone gives us common language to make that connection. And the conversation I'd have with him is a connection I'd have with my students. How do you know what you know? Where are the Muslim military personnel you know? Have you spoken to anybody about what the Quran or what Islam teaches? And try to open them up to seeing the world through my eyes as well.
I think it's very possible. One of the things I've noticed, and I actually think is something that we have to work on as well, is that many people who say the things that he said do actually like Muslims. They may have Muslim friends. They may know Muslims. But those Muslims that they know are nice and the exception to the bigger picture that he painted of the religion as a whole. And so I think what I would want to talk about is he said he's studied a lot about the tradition or about people. So I'd want to ask what he studied, what has he read, and maybe offer some other things that he could read or other people he could talk to. Because you can't take one-fourth of the world's population and think you're going to know everything about them from a limited source.
It's part of what we're battling here before we go. Not only a prevailing sense of the other from Americans who don't have experience with them, but also a sense that ISIS, that the jihadists have painted Islam in a way that bears directly on your lives and the way people view you and your fellow Muslims.
Absolutely. And it's not just ISIS, though. I would want to underscore that it is also a number of people and institutions in this country that have set out to characterize Islam in the same way that ISIS intends to characterize Islam. And it's that two sides of the coin working together. They have the exact same storyline about the tradition. The majority of Muslims are sitting around thinking, that's not my tradition. I don't know what they're talking about. That's not how I live my life. That's not what I care about. But those two entities, whether it's violent extremist Muslims or self-identified Muslims or other people who are propagating anti-Muslim literature and rhetoric, and some of the bestsellers on Islam in this country are written by those people. So it's from both sides.
You know, we sometimes forget the day-to-day interactions we have with Muslims, particularly in major urban areas or through television. We forget that Dave Chappelle and A Tribe Called Quest hosted Saturday Night Live the Saturday after the election. And that was black Muslim men performing as guests on Saturday Night Live. We forget about the Taj Mahal was built by Muslims. We forget the best-selling poet in America, Rumi, is a Muslim. You know, and so there are all these moments where we are thinking about and interacting with American Muslims or broader Muslim thought that we're not as conscious of. And I think sometimes highlighting that the human element that ties us all together as a country, Muslim and non-Muslim, is such an important part of this conversation.
Dr. Hussein Rashid is a professor of religion at Barnard College and a Truman National Security Fellow. Jerusha Lamptey is a professor of Islam at Union Theological Seminary and author of the book Never Holy Other. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As a Syrian, as a Muslim, as a refugee, as a woman, it means that the stability that I fled to the United States looking for, it doesn't exist anymore.
Let's look deeper now at some of the real human consequences of this immigration ban. President Trump has used words like vetting of immigrants and refugees and, quote, extreme vetting, something the president has promised, will now be in place. What do those words mean? What does vetting amount to as immigrants already here remember it? And what do they fear will be faced by friends and family trying to enter the U.S. now? Sena Mustafa is a 25-year-old Syrian refugee who arrived in the U.S. in 2013, penniless and alone, to attend a class sponsored by the State Department. She remained. And she says it was a positive experience to be welcomed with open arms in the U.S. and the hope of the American dream. But the latest travel ban by the Trump administration has put her family, who have been in the process of applying for resettlement to the U.S. from Syria, for 3 years in a vulnerable place, tarnishing, in her view, that positive experience.
The hope to come to the United States and build a new life and be united after the war torn us in Syria is also this dream doesn't exist anymore, I believe.
What happened to you when you came to the United States? Did the government investigate you, talk to members of your family,
yes,
attempt to figure out if stories you were telling on your applications were true? Were you aware of that investigation as
sure.
It was going on?
Of course. When you seek asylum, of course, there's a huge vetting and security screening process that happens to your application. And the application itself, it's a lot of work. It's basically, you work with a lawyer. You can't work it alone even. And you need to provide evidences that prove going back to your country would risk your life personally. So, of course, I had to bring a lot of evidences to prove this. And once done this, it takes them a while to really security screen you and, you know, all the United States security agencies vet you, basically.
And this is far more than just checking in your luggage.
Oh, it's far more than that. For example, also my family who are refugees in Turkey and trying to be resettled to the United States, they have been in process for resettlement. For 3 years, they have been going through security screening by 12 United States security screening agencies. Yet, they are not accepted to come here. And due to the executive orders now, their file got suspended like other refugees.
So 3 years has already passed.
Yes.
And now this new order shuts things down completely.
Exactly. I mean, they claim that it's only for 120 days, then we'll see what's going to happen. But, I mean, after 120 days, are they going to welcome us more? I'm sure other laws and other orders will come out.
What is your understanding of the difference between vetting and extreme vetting that we've heard a lot here in the U.S.?
This is what I'm trying to understand from Mr. Trump, claiming that extreme vetting will happen. What more extreme than this could happen? I mean, when you come here, every single country that you have visited or traveled, even for tourism reasons, they vet you in every single country you have traveled to. They vet you in your own country. They vet you in your host country. They vet you for your, like, going back, tracing your grandfathers. What more could be done? Because I think we're already going through extreme vetting.
You pose absolutely no threat to the United States on any level, right?
I believe so. You know, even statistics showed that very few terror attacks that were conducted by refugees or immigrants. Actually, most of the time, they are just white people.
Have you ever known anyone from your country or others who was caught by this vetting process, who you believed was, in fact, a threat?
Actually, it has never happened to anyone I know of. Those who have reputation or have done something bad, they would not apply to the United States, period. You know, knowing what they will go through and knowing that the amount and the level of security screening. Most of the terror attacks that happened here, for example, were conducted by United States citizens. They could have, like, be first or second generation immigrants, but they are not coming on a visa waiver program or refugee program.
All right. So as someone who is very experienced with the practice of this vetting, if you were in a position to advise President Trump, what would you tell President Trump the threat is?
Yeah, I think the threat is here now. I think when you see now the incidents that when people discriminate against people in the United States, having given the green light by their own president, in discriminating against other people, I think this is the threat we're facing now. I am afraid now of walking in the street sometimes and being discriminated against. And it's happening, and not only on a people level, it's happening. We see videos now on a policy level when the president himself discriminates against reporters and journalists on the media and on TV, millions of people watching it, and no one says anything. And other people, those who look up to him, they see a role model in him. I think this is the threat.
Emotionally, how are you feeling about all of this?
I'm not feeling well at all. You know, when we fled Syria, you know, you flee and you think stability or safety is in your host country. And we have suffered a lot. We have lost a lot. We have sacrificed a lot. So when I came to the United States, I really was hoping that it's a place I will be able to build something. And eventually I will be able to be reunited with my family here. But now, I actually cannot leave the country. If I leave, I can't come back. After 3 years and a half of being here and actually going through a lot of hardships to get this asylum, to get this refugee status, to get then my green card, you know, now if I leave, I can't come back. And the same, my family cannot come here. Our pain doesn't end with Syria borders.
Does this feel like a Muslim ban to you?
I mean, I don't need to feel it. It says it explicitly in words that the 7 Muslim countries, Muslim refugees, and it's a Muslim ban. And the problem is when President of the United States, when he says that Islamic terrorist, I mean, this is the problem. Terrorism has no religion. And when you are associating one religion with this label always, this actually changes people. It's brainwashing for people's mind.
You know, President Obama didn't exactly have the best reputation on, shutting down the border or deportations. How would you compare what Donald Trump is doing with what happened during the Obama administration and even the George W. Bush administration?
I'm aware of that many Mexicans, unfortunately, were deported during Obama administration, and it is very upsetting. But I feel like now the level that we have reached with Trump is beyond this. It's violating the international laws. It's violating the U.S. Constitution itself.
Senator Mustafa, thank you so much. I really appreciate you speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
It turns out that the Flint water crisis may define the Obama administration's Environmental Protection Agency as much as fighting climate change. Residents of Flint were never warned of their lead-contaminated water when the city switched water sources and didn't follow EPA rules for avoiding contamination. More than 1,700 Flint citizens are taking the Environmental Protection Agency and other government agencies to court, seeking $770 million in damages. The EPA's competing responsibility for watching global climate and local water pipes. Too much to ask? We'll meet one of the attorneys representing the Flint residents, Julie Hurwitz, and lead plaintiff and a Flint, Michigan resident, Jan Burgess. Jan told us about how she's been struggling with all the health problems in recent years, connected possibly to the contamination.
Well, it's kind of hard to make a direct connection between the water and illnesses that I have started suffering. But these are things that I never had before. I have a wildly fluctuating thyroid now, and that can cause all kinds of problems. Part of my esophagus is worn away. And as I said, these are things that I didn't have before.
But you spent months, if not years, being afraid of your water, being afraid of your own.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can't trust it. You know, once you actually see that water with the particles floating in it and you smell the scummy, like it's like bad algae and then chlorination that's way worse than any pool that you would want to get into. You know, once you see those things, smell them and taste them, yeah, it's very worrisome. You worry about showering. You worry about cooking with it. It's sort of, my doctor kind of compares this to a form of PTSD. He said that's what's raising your anxiety. And I do agree with him there. I think about it a lot.
What's your argument in court for seeking relief here and the damages? Part of the whole reason for this catastrophe was the argument made by some agencies that Flint didn't have the funds to properly address its own water supply for one reason or another.
Well, I think that's pretty ridiculous. All it would have taken is about $100 a day to put in the anti-corrosives. And even though Flint was under an emergency manager, they decided to use money in other ways. Apparently, the water wasn't important.
Speaking with Jan Burgess, one of the citizens of Flint, whose water supply, as you could hear there, was contaminated in the Flint City water catastrophe. Now a major legal concern, a legal lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency and other levels of state and city government. Julie Hurwitz, a civil rights attorney. Any insight into what the argument on the defense side is going to be and any sense of how these damages are going to compensate for what people like Jan have gone through?
Well, to answer your first question, the defenses so far that have been presented have been pathetic. The only defense they have is our procedural defenses at this point, and they are taking advantage of every single opportunity to assert those defenses. As far as whether there is a chance of sitting down at a table and negotiating some settlement, we believe that that would be the right thing to do in order to fully and fairly compensate this community. What it would take to fully compensate them, there's no amount of money that could make this community whole. The racial and economic injustice that has occurred from these decisions and actions on the part of our government and some private corporations is incalculable. We've asked for $722 million. That's not even enough. What value can you put on people's health and their quality of life? What value can you put on the expectation that we all have to be able to turn our tap water on in our own homes and know that it's safe to drink and to wash our children's clothes with? We don't know how the government is going to continue to attempt to defend itself. What we do know is that we are not going away and that they can exhaust all of their procedural and technical defenses and all of their appeals, and We are not going away. We want all of these defendants to know, from the EPA on down to the individual officials who participated in this travesty, that we are here to stay, and all we want is justice for this community. There were decisions made, we strongly believe, that are based on the fact that this was a predominantly impoverished community and a predominantly African-American community, and they made these decisions in order to save a few dollars, knowing that down the road they were going to make a lot of money because this community was dispensable. You can't imagine the kind of fear and the kind of the trauma that every single person in that community is experiencing from the knowledge that they thought they could trust their regulators. They thought they could trust those who they elected to govern them. And it all turned out to be one huge lie.
And a home, a happy home with a toxic water supply is just not a happy home.
No, we love our home in Flint. I love Flint. It's a wonderful historical city. It's done things for the country that no other little city has. We formed the middle class here. I mean, we are important, regardless of what the state officials seem to think and the EPA. But that's my home. I've been there 25 years. It's a home that we want to retire in. We're entitled to those things. We pay our taxes. We do everything we're supposed to do. We're entitled to having what we take for granted and that we pay for, like water, be safe to use.
That was Jen Burgess, resident of Flint and the lead plaintiff in the case against the EPA. Julie Hurwitz is a civil rights attorney and partner at the Goodman and Hurwitz Law Firm. She's representing the Flint residents in that case. We reached out to the EPA for comment, and they said the agency does not comment on pending litigation. This is the sound of Israeli security forces removing settlers from an illegal town called Amona. Here's the Palestinian representative to the United States, Mayan Arakat, condemning all such settlements following the UN resolution on Israeli settlement policy, a resolution that the Obama administration chose to abstain on, thereby assuring its passage.
The Israelis are trying to ignore the fact that they have been warned many times over by the Palestinians, by the United States, by the international community, that they cannot have both land and peace.
The irony here is that the Israelis are pushing ahead, building new settlements all over occupied territories. And the Israeli government may perceive a green light coming from Washington in words like this from candidate, now President, Donald Trump.
When I become president, the days of treating Israel like a second-class citizen will end on day one. We will move the American embassy to the eternal capital of the Jewish people, Jerusalem.
That's Trump speaking to the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, as a candidate. Last week, the Israeli parliament approved 2,500 new homes in the West Bank, over 500 in East Jerusalem. Yesterday, 3,000 more homes were authorized by the government. Is this now also policy of the U.S. government? After decades of unsuccessfully demanding a settlement freeze by Israel or an end to settlements? Director Shimon Dotan's documentary, The Settlers, traces the history of Israeli settlements, which dates back to the country's victory over Jordan and the Arab world in the Six-Day War of 1967. The settlers have irrevocably changed the character of Israel, Dotan says, and not for the better.
Evidently, the new avalanche of building of settlements, of new housing, etc., is a result of the new president in the United States. Now, in a way, it plays into everything that is the absolute contradiction of the essence of the state of Israel. Zionism was founded as a secular enterprise with its main goal to provide safe haven to persecuted Jews. It was never designed to fulfill biblical prophecies or to hasten the arrival of the Messiah. So what we are witnessing now is a complete takeover of religious expansionist tendencies in favor of the very essence of the state of Israel.
I want you to respond to a statement from the defense ministry, Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman, who said on Tuesday night that, quote, we are in a new era where life in Judea and Samaria, the biblical terms for the West Bank, is returning to its normal course. What does that mean, normal course? What is that about?
That has the same validity as many of the statements that are coming from this side of the ocean. And if Donald Trump became the new godfather of the settlement enterprise, it is in fact a testimony to the Israeli leaders who embraces him and to the entire settlement enterprise.
Well, in your film about the settlers and who they are, they do represent individuals who believe that they are hastening the arrival of the Messiah. There are some who believe that this is a military endeavor here. But there are also people who are just commuters who live outside of Tel Aviv that happens to be in territory, say, for instance, Ariel, on the other side of what used to be called the Green Line. What did your film attempt to show about this very diverse group of people?
Well, the 400,000 or so settlers, Israeli settlers that live in the West Bank, are divided in a very sharp way. About 20% of them are religiously, ideologically motivated, and the vast majority are there for economic housing reasons. And it's quite tragic. And the government of Israel uses in a very cynical way the lack of proper housing in Israel proper and is building thousands of new housing in the West Bank to achieve their political goals and to play into the hands of the settlers movement.
Let's listen to the founder of the Palestinian Human Rights Organization, Raja Shahada, who is speaking in your film.
We saw trailers bringing mobile homes. By the time we came back in the afternoon, the mobile homes had been placed on the land. And I turned to the passenger, my friend who was driving with me, and I told him, you know, anything that is built so quickly can be taken away so quickly. And he said, I'm not so sure. And these words ring in my head to this day, because he was right and I was wrong.
Where in the state of Israel or Palestine is he speaking of? Can you help to explain what he's talking about?
Well, Raja Shahada, that was the founder of Al-Haq, the first Palestinian human rights organization, talks about the Ramallah region. And his observation is very telling. No one believed in the early phase of the settlement movement that it's going to grow and become an entity that in effect kidnapped the state of Israel. And the way that it happened is could be a lesson in history, but now we are facing a situation where it's almost irreversible.
Going way back to Camp David, and I'm old enough to remember, I remember when the settlement of Yamit in the Sinai was dismantled as part of the settlement with Egypt that gave the Sinai back to Egypt. Do you think that the U.S. consistent policy opposing settlements constrained Israel during this period of time, and that once that constraint is gone, the two-state solution is dead?
I don't think that the two-state solution is dead, for the mere fact that there is no other way. We can take for the next year, for the next decade, those alternatives that we are witnessing now. But on the long term, you have a population of 2.8 million Palestinians who are living in the West Bank, close to 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, more than 1.5 million Palestinians living in Israel proper. This population is not going anywhere. And if the state of Israel wants to maintain its democracy, wants to maintain its, I would say, Jewish heritage, I'm not talking about religion, it must find a way to live in peace with the Palestinian neighbors. I've just mentioned, I don't know if you're aware of that, that the film The Settlers is going to be screened in New York and Los Angeles on March 3rd theatrically at Film Forum and other places. And so far, I'm getting a very strong response to the reality that the film puts forward from many American viewers, and many of them do not necessarily are or were before they watched the film opposed the settlement enterprise or saw it as something that is detrimental to the state of Israel. And I think that it's quite telling because we are facing a tremendous wave of misinformation, of using religious sentiment in order to provoke a political response.
Shimon Dotan is writer and director of the film The Settlers. He's a professor of political cinema at the NYU Graduate School of Journalism. Good luck on your film, and we hope to see audiences benefit from this film over the course of the next weeks and months. Shimon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes, this is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and Defense Secretary James Mattis is making his first overseas trip. He landed in Seoul, South Korea today. He will be holding a number of talks in South Korea and Japan. He'll meet with defense ministers and government officials from both nations to discuss the United States' stand in the Pacific. North Korea's long-range missile capability will also be under discussion. Bonnie Glaser is the senior advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Bonnie.
Thank you for having me on, John.
So, Bonnie, how much of an explainer will Secretary Mattis have to be on this trip regarding Trump's statements about foreign policy made during and after the campaign?
The main purpose, I think, and message of Secretary Mattis's visit both to Seoul and Tokyo is to bring a message of reassurance, to reaffirm U.S. commitment to our alliances and to U.S. engagement in the region. There's been a lot of anxiety in Asia and elsewhere, but particularly where Donald Trump during the campaign suggested that these allies should pay more for U.S. troops or possibly even risk having U.S. forces withdrawn. At the same time, there's growing security threats that are seen by Japan and Korea coming from China and from North Korea. So this is an opportunity, I think, to send a message of consistency about our commitments and our determination to work together with our allies going forward.
Some of this defense policy is tied up with trade. The withdrawal from TPP is being portrayed by the Chinese as a victory, a huge victory for them in Asia, giving them a sort of advantage over all the other nations in the region. Is that how it's being perceived by those nations? And finally, is it widely known that Donald Trump reportedly owes money to China in his various businesses and is that understood by Asians around the region?
Well, I think that Asians are worried about the U.S. economic commitment to the region. And in the absence of TPP, which Donald Trump has now withdrawn from, it's not really clear what the U.S. strategy is going to be going forward other than forging bilateral free trade agreements with countries, which may take some time. And so I think there is a sense that this has created a vacuum in the region, that China can portray itself as a leader of economic integration, even though its ideas are not necessarily the kinds of free trade agreements that Japan and other allies and countries in the region really wanted to see. I don't know how widely understood the issue is of Donald Trump and his business legacy and the debts that he owes to China and other countries and many companies around the world. But people are looking to learn more about the new Trump administration, and there really is a lot of uncertainty.
Does North Korea view the United States as being beholden to China, and is that a green light for maybe some aggression?
Well, I don't think that North Korea sees the U.S. as beholden to China. The North Koreans have their own playbook and their own agenda. There are indications they're going to be conducting another test of an intercontinental ballistic missile soon, possibly another nuclear test. And there really is a need for the U.S. to align itself very closely in terms of its policies with our allies and send a message of firm commitment to their security and our extended deterrence to use the full range of capabilities that we have to come to the defense of these nations.
Bonnie Glaser, Senior Advisor for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Each day, in dramatic and seemingly choreographed signing ceremonies at the White House, President Donald Trump announces new executive orders and nominees for cabinet positions. He also methodically claims to be repealing or erasing Obama-era policies and regulations, particularly environmental ones. A law known as the Congressional Review Act of 1996 gives Trump and Congress, that's also doing some of the fine print here, the authority to do all of this. Todd Zwillick is Takeaway Washington correspondent. Tell me more about the CRA of 1996.
Now, the CRA dates back to the Newt Gingrich Republican House and the Contract with America. You remember that.
Sure.
This was when that Republican sweep wanted to undo regulations that they viewed to be anti-business. Of course, there are a whole bunch teed up for this week. The House has been passing these pretty easily. It's easy for House Republicans to do this, and some of them have gone to the Senate now, John. Basically, what the CRA lets Congress do is repeal regulations that were passed or implemented at the very end of a previous administration, but the president has to sign off on it. So it's not usually used because you need this perfect storm of the opposite majority, regulations that are young enough that they were at the very end of the last administration, but also a new president who's willing to sign it to undo them. It's only really been used once in the past. This was back in the George H.W. Bush administration when Congress undid a sort of infamous regulation from OSHA on ergonomics, an ergonomic workplace standard. Everybody kind of laughed at it, maligned that regulation, and Congress undid it using this law. But here comes another five or six times that Congress wants to do this. And some of these are important. There's one big one that protects waterways near coal mines. Obama implemented a regulation back in the summer that would restrict how much coal mining waste, basically heavy metals, mining companies can dump into waterways, and would also force them to set up cleanup funds for waterways. So they're going to undo that one. There's another one on methane flaring. You know, when you drive by a refinery and you see those big posts sticking up in the air with a flame on the top, they're flaming methane there. A regulation would restrict the ability to do that. Obama said you should capture that and sell it off because it's a potent greenhouse gas. And then there's a third one that's important from Dodd-Frank, a rule from last year that would require oil companies that are listed on the stock exchange to publicly disclose payments that they make to foreign governments for drilling rights. That was under Dodd-Frank. Now, Rex Tillerson, when he was CEO of Exxon, is now the Secretary of State, was one guy who lobbied hard against this rule so that companies like Exxon, many other companies too, John, wouldn't have to disclose these payments. Now, if these all sound like they are basically special interest favors to big companies, I ask this question to Pete Sessions, a conservative Republican chairman of the Rules Committee from Texas, and I said, these don't sound like sort of pro-worker. These sound like pro-corporation. Here's what he said.
Well, they were aimed at these political entities that you talk about to harm them. Why shouldn't we be for saving them? If they were meant to, for their demise, parasites designed to kill the host. You know, we try and balance things out, and we're going to do that. The Republican Party will balance it out and make the Democrats be the fools that they are on this issue.
Parasites, fools, you know, it's hard to know what's actually going on in Washington with language like that. But it also looks like legislation by photo op, Todd. What does Congress say about that?
Yeah, here's Jim McGovern. He's a liberal Democrat. He basically says this is a meat-axe approach, that these regulations take a long time to implement. Why should Congress come along with a bludgeon and undo them?
There are a lot of regulations that are imperfect, and there may be some that should be repealed. But let's go through a thoughtful process to determine that. Rather than, you know, picking, you know, catchy titles and bringing them to the floor, you know, and having people vote yes or no. This is mindless legislating. This doesn't make any sense.
Is this perceived as bypassing the normal procedures of Congress, or is this just sort of the beginning of the Trump administration and things are going to settle down?
Well, it's all completely legal. The CRA is a law. People who want these environmental regulations and others don't approve of all this stuff, and they think that regulations have their place. I think the big objection here is that regulations aren't dreamt up in the Oval Office. They're made over years and years with input from thousands of different stakeholders. Congress then comes along if they don't like one, and if the planets align, John, they can get rid of them. And that's what they're doing.
Transitions from one administration to the other and environmental policy. We'll talk more about that in a moment. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Speaking of the idea of normal this hour, we note how the president chose to signify the beginning of Black History Month yesterday.
They have a museum, the National Mall, where people can learn about Reverend King, so many other things. Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice.
Frederick Douglass, of course, died in 1895 and is remembered as the most influential African-American of the 19th century. Before the end of February, there's still time to Google Frederick Douglass or anyone else important in American history. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.